it up for questions, and people should feel free during questions to answer if they want.
Start up.
Is Shiite fundamentalism a, does that represent the threat to this system?
One of the threats. I mean, it's not just Shiite fundamentalism, but various forms of religious fundamentalism have developed and are pretty powerful in the region, all the way over to North Africa. You saw what just happened in Algeria. And that's natural, too. I mean, as secular nationalism fails, people turn to other forms of identification. Religious fundamentalism is another one. That shouldn't look too strange to us, because the same thing's happening in the United States. In the United States, secular democracy is failing. More and more people feel that the political system has nothing to do with them. You can see that in polls and studies and so on, and you get the natural result, a very sharp increase in religious fundamentalism, which is just extraordinary in the United States. The United States is off the chart as compared with any other industrial society in this respect. And what's happening here is, you know, kind of a lesser fashion, what's happening in the Middle East too, and I think for the same reason. The PLO, for example, was secular nationalist. Other forms of secular nationalism have failed. Nasser, for example. They couldn't get what they wanted, the West wouldn't allow it, and so on and so forth. So people turned to fundamentalism. What's more, the West and Israel have actually supported that. That was a bad tactical error, but they supported it. They didn't realize what they were doing. But in Lebanon, for example, Israel, when it was trying to control Lebanon, Israel tried to destroy the secular nationalists. That's what the war is about. You want to destroy the PLO so they don't trouble you with all these negotiations offers and things. And what they instigated was what people call the Shiite fundamentalism. That was the alternative. Well, you know, Israel really had a tiger by the tail on that one, and the Shiite fundamentalist resistance drove them out of the country. You know, they weren't counting on people who are going to be suicide bombers who go in and blow up your military camp and so on. The same thing is happening in the occupied territories. For the first, at least year and a half of the Intifada, Israel was almost openly supporting Hamas, the fundamentalist movement. The leader of Hamas, Sheikh Yassin in Gaza, who was a violent anti-Semite, I mean, killer Jews and so on, he was given very nice treatment. They liked him. Young fundamentalist militants were being bussed in by Israel to West Bank universities to break up demonstrations by secular students. And the logic was the same. The logic is the real threat is secular nationalism. The real threat is people who would be willing to negotiate and so on. We can do just fine with these guys who say kill all the Jews because we have no problem about dealing with them. Well, again, they kind of got a tiger by the tail on that one, too. And I don't know how happy they are that this is what they were doing, because once you get these forces going, they go in directions that are hard to control. And it's happening in Algeria. That's why they had to cancel the elections. And yes, this is happening all throughout the region. I think the causes are pretty obvious, and it's very likely to continue as long as there's no possibility of realizing the aims of reform, and which is drastically needed, not only political reform, social reform is just, you know, huge priority there. If it can't be reached, people are going to turn to other forms of struggle, and they may be pretty crazy.
I have two questions. Why are Germany and Japan acceding to this? And secondly, the U.S. goal in the Gulf War was to establish the German force. In what sense was the war a catastrophe?
It was a political catastrophe. It was a political catastrophe that was impossible to cover up the fact that the U.S. ended up supporting Saddam Hussein exactly as it had been supporting him up till August 1990. It takes a lot of effort to suppress the fact that the U.S. supported Saddam Hussein as he put down the popular uprisings, and furthermore that the U.S. is supporting the Emir of Kuwait as he destroys the democratic initiatives that were being developed there. And the U.S. position was to block any democratic opening. The State Department even conceded that George Bush refused to use the word democracy even in private communications to the Emir of Kuwait, because they thought that'd be too much interference in their internal affairs. You know, we're very delicate about those matters. That's kind of hard to cover up. I mean, yes, the rule of force was established, but the political outcome is extremely hard to deal with. I mean, especially after, it was interesting the way you remember, like last March and so on. The suppression of the Shiites was easy to handle. I mean, they're just dirty Arabs. You want to kill them, that's no business. The Kurds was a harder problem. you know, they got the kids have blue eyes and kind of Aryan features and that sort of thing. And therefore there was some, you know, the Kurdish suppression got a big play. And after the big fuss about Saddam, you know, this monster, you know, so on, then he goes around killing the Kurds, these Aryans, for the U.S. to be backing it up, that was too much even for the media to handle, you know, so they kind of had some problems with that one. It was interesting the way they did handle it, and describe it if you like, but one of the ways they handled it was by flat out lying about the Arab states. You read the New York Times, you read it closely, they say, well, you know, it's kind of unpleasant that we got to do this, we have to do it for stability, and there's unanimity among the Arab clients over this. That was the report in the New York Times. The main report was April 10th from Damascus. Alan Cowell was a Middle East correspondent. Just out of curiosity, I looked at the Egyptian press the day before, April 9th in the Egyptian press. Egypt is the only one of the clients that even exists. I mean, of the other Arab states, six of them are family dictatorships, I mean, the nine states. The seventh is Syria, you know, run by Hafez al-Assad, who's indistinguishable from Saddam Hussein. The only, I mean, Egypt's a tyranny, but kind of a soft tyranny by standards of the region, and there's some openness there. So naturally, you want to find out about this unanimity, you look at the Egyptian press, well, al-Ahram, you know, kind of like the Egyptian New York Times. The day before that report about the unanimity in the Arab states, al-Ahram had a huge article by the deputy editor denouncing the United States for supporting Saddam Hussein and the crushing of the rebellions, and saying this just proves what we've been saying all along, that the only U.S. interest in the region was to destroy and weaken the Arab world and reinstate its own authority. All right, next day, New York Times tells you, yeah, well, the Arab states agree with us, much as we don't like it, we got to have stability so we suppress, you know, back Saddam Hussein and try to get the best of all worlds. Okay, so this is that. Now, what about Europe and Japan? Well, I think part of the thing is they recognize reality. The U.S. was always somewhat deterred in the use of military force. The U.S. has always been the dominant military power. And it used to there used to be a deterrent, Soviet Union. I mean, whatever you think of it, you know, doesn't matter. It was a deterrent. 10 years earlier, the U.S. and Britain wouldn't have dared to put 500,000 troops in the field because it would have been too dangerous. You know, you'd get into trouble. In fact, every Middle East war since 1958 has come, the U.S. invasion of Lebanon, has come close to a nuclear war. There was always a threat of nuclear war, and sometimes it was not far. McNamara, for example, who was then Secretary of Defense, said that in 1967, in his words, we damn near had war, as there was a confrontation between the Russian and American fleets, and the American fleet turned around some Russian vessels, and the same thing happened every time. So you had to back off, it was just too dangerous. With the Russians gone from the scene, the U.S. and Britain could resort to their traditional stand. You just use arbitrary force against defenseless enemies, and that, you know, frees up a lot of options. And that was demonstrated in the Gulf. So Europe and Japan recognize it, but I suspect there's another factor. I mean, I can't prove this, but here's what I'd recommend that you keep your eyes on. The collapse of the Soviet Union, what that really means is that the whole Eastern Bloc is being restored to its traditional role as a colony of Western Europe. Remember that whole region prior to the Bolshevik Revolution and then the Iron Curtain, I mean, most of that region, not all of it, like not Czechoslovakia, but most of the region was a colony of the West. It was third world, you know, kind of deep third world. The Bolshevik Revolution pulled it out, moved in its own direction. It was, you know, one of these, it was kind of like Grenada in a way, except a huge Grenada. You know, it was a move towards independence, but in this case on the part of a huge part of the third world, not a little speck. And the reaction was the same as always. You got to stop it. Grenada, you knock them off on a weekend. This one took 70 years, you know, but it's done. And now the area is reverting to its traditional status. You know, you impose IMF structural adjustment and turn to the standard two-tiered societies, and they're open to exploitation. The problem for the U.S. is not happy about this. And the reason is that after the last 10 years, when the U.S. economy suffered a rather severe blow under Reagan-Bush economic policies, the U.S. is a deeply indebted country. We used to be capital rich just 10 years ago. We're now capital poor. The U.S. cannot participate in the robbery of Eastern Europe. That's going to be, the Germans are going to play that. They're way ahead. And if there's any more opportunities, the Japanese will move in. So far they're waiting to see if it's going to pay off. But the U.S. can't get in that game where there's much indebtedness at every level, federal, state, corporate, even household debt. That's the result of the economic policies of the last 10 years. That means that's why the U.S. is always dragging its feet. Like just last August, remember, Bush made a speech kind of pleading with Ukraine not to move towards independence, and that's been going on all through the decade for this reason. But one likely concomitant to this, I kind of suspect it's going on, though I don't have any evidence, is that Europe, meaning Germany and its periphery, is probably moving towards an oil deal with Russia. That would be the natural thing for them to do. I mean, Russia is now a big third world country with a lot of resources that can be robbed. And it has plenty of oil. You know, they need Western technology, but Germany and Japan can give them the technology. And if that worked, I'm really just guessing. I don't see any evidence for it. But it seems to me it's kind of like in the cards. And if that happens, Europe and Japan's concern for the Middle East will decline because they'll have another source of resources. It's not just oil, but minerals and everything else. In fact, all of the third world resources that the U.S. has largely dominated, that situation is going to change with this big new third world coming along, rich in resources, plenty of opportunities for investment, you know, a lot of cheap labor and so on and so forth. And if indeed Germany and its periphery and probably later Japan move in to exploit that region, that'll change the balance of the world system considerably, and it'll possibly lessen their interest in the Middle East. So I suspect that's kind of like a secondary factor, but as I say, that's real speculation. I haven't seen any evidence for that yet.
Picture of the future and what you call the settlers, nationalist forces have quite a job ahead of them from your remarks, especially on the issue of democracy, economic progressive change and so on. But I want to go back to the Palestinian delegation. These people in Washington are different. They're not really here over there from the occupied territories. They're pragmatic, and they're a different kind of leaders. But still, obviously, they have failed, or they have inched very, very slowly. So how do you evaluate their work, and what would you recommend them to do? I mean, do you have any suggestions to them? What prospects for success do they have?
Well, my feeling is they're, first of all, you know, I mean, there's plenty of criticisms you can make of the PLO. I mean, I've been very critical of them for 20 years, and I think they're one of the most inefficient, incompetent, and corrupt third world movements I've ever had anything to do with, I should tell you. But nevertheless, it is not correct to say that they were not pragmatic. I mean, the PLO, right through the 80s, they did it sort of stupidly and incompetently, but they continually came forward with proposals for negotiations leading to mutual recognition. I mean, that's just a fact. You know, you can love them or hate them or whatever, but that's a fact. In this respect, they were no different from Hanan Ashrawi and any of the other West Bank leaders. They are more sophisticated, you're right. They're middle class, sophisticated, you know, urbane, and so on. That sells to the American audience better, but notice how it sells. They're getting a very good press. But look closely at the acclaim, right? The acclaim is, you know, you read in the New York Times, Clyde Haberman or, you know, any of these guys, they're just full of praise for the Palestinian leadership because they have finally self-accommodated to reality and are no longer making unrealistic demands for independence. So therefore, they're nice guys. They're doing what we tell them. Now, I'm not saying that they're selling out, but I'm saying that their forthcoming attitude is being hailed because it's being interpreted as it sort of filters through the U.S. doctrinal system as self-accommodation with reality, reality being we run the show and everybody does what we say. Well, you know, you ask what alternative they have, I don't think they have a lot of an alternative. I mean, one good thing that they're doing is for the first time, they're presenting the Palestinian case, which is always there, with some plausibility to an American audience. Now, people have been trying to get the PLO to do this for years. I don't know how much you've been in on these discussions, but I've been involved, Ed Said's been involved, others, all kind of meetings and so on. They never saw the slightest reason to try to appeal to the American people. They had ample opportunities, they had huge resources, they just didn't see the point. And I think there are all kind of reasons for that. anyhow, that's what the truth was. I think it's the only third world movement I've ever had any contact with that didn't see the point of trying to, say, help build a solidarity movement, appeal to the American people. I mean, even the North Koreans, in their own crazy way, tried to do this. They'd send the Pyongyang Times around or something. But and that's really important, you know, because it's only popular pressures in the United States that can, first of all, constrain force and sometimes change policy. You know, you're not going to appeal to guys in smoke-filled rooms the way they think business is done. They understand perfectly well they're going to do it their way. Well, the new leadership is doing that. Whether it'll make any difference or not seems to me to depend on whether, in fact, a significant solidarity movement develops, which could influence and change American policy. Short of that, it's not going to happen. Short of that, we'll get the New York Times version. You know, nice guys, self-accommodating to reality, doing what we tell them. And I wouldn't criticize what they've been doing. I don't think they have a lot of options. I mean, there are people in the occupied territories who are strongly opposed to the participation. I disagree with them. I think they should participate, but without illusions. Right after the Madrid conference opened, there were tremendous illusions in the occupied territories. You know, there was a sense we finally, you know, got the U.S. on our side, everything's going to change, we're going to march on to victory. I thought that was very dangerous. And I think by now, as far as I can tell from my Palestinian friends there, the illusions have pretty much disappeared. The trouble is that disappearing of elimination of the illusions, which are unrealistic, can lead to other forms of irrationality. I think it's kind of unpredictable, and it's kind of not our business anyway. They'll do what they do. Our business would be to, as I see it, to try to build up the kind of solidarity movement which would enable those initiatives to get some support and to pressure U.S. policy. After all, that's the only thing under our influence, not what happens in Ramallah.
You said you read the Arab or the Egyptian press, and the next day you knew that it was a lie when you read the New York Times. How do you know what newspaper to believe when they're lying?
It's not to believe. I mean, if the New York Times says Egypt is supporting our position on backing Saddam Hussein, you can look at Al Ahram and find out if Egypt is backing the U.S. position on supporting Saddam Hussein. And they weren't. They were denouncing it. That's just a fact. It's not a matter of who you believe. You know, the fact of the matter, unquestionable fact, is that the major, Al Ahram is, you know, it's the major paper, the respectable paper in Egypt. Its editor came out with a big denunciation of the U.S. policy of supporting Saddam Hussein the day before the New York Times reported that they were supporting our policy. Okay, there's the facts. Now, you know, what Egypt's actual policy was, that you can speculate about. But this is a semi-governmental paper. You know, Al Ahram does not publish things that are in conflict with the position of the government of Egypt. It's the expression of, you know, it's kind of semi-official. You know, it's not the official newspaper, but really close. I mean, the New York Times is just flat out lying because that was the requirement at the time. Doesn't make any difference. Nobody's ever going to, I mean, it's exposed in the alternative press, but they don't care. You know, they don't care if they're exposed in Z Magazine. Just laugh.
To go back onto the point of Germany and Japan, I like what you said about the opening of Russia and the Eastern Bloc onto Germany and Japan, and that they did not need to depend anymore on the Middle East for oil. Does that mean, though, that they did not need to fear the U.S. Leverage on the oil, and that they can play a bigger role in the Middle East peace process, a more independent role?
Well, first of all, let me not exaggerate. I don't think they're losing their concern over the Middle East. You know, first of all, remember, this talk about an oil deal with Russia is a guess. I haven't seen any evidence for it. It just looks to me natural, you know. But even if it goes through, they're still going to be dependent on Middle East oil. Whatever they do, the major cheap available energy resource is the Arabian Peninsula and that region. That's going to remain that way for a long time. So yes, they'll be dependent, maybe less dependent, but dependent on the Gulf region. But I think they are now more willing to recognize U.S. domination of it without any even symbolic interference. Partly for that reason, partly because of the success of the use of force, in which they can't compete. And they can compete economically, but not militarily. whether they have backed out of the peace process. I hate to use the term, but this thing that's called the peace process, they've backed out of. In fact, the backing out is pretty remarkable. It's not just that the European community has abandoned all of its own positions, as it has. They're no longer calling for Palestinian self-determination, you'll notice. This is the first year that, year isn't over yet, but it's the first UN session that I can remember when there was no proposal for an international conference and recognition of the Palestinian self-determination. No proposal. The Arab states didn't feel pressed to make their symbolic gesture to placate their own populations, and the European community didn't care. That's a change. Furthermore, it's interesting if you read the European press now. It's pretty remarkable, in fact. The European press is now totally brainwashed by the United States on this issue. They just repeat the propaganda they heard yesterday from the United States. I mean, the level of critical discussion has declined radically. Actually, that happened during the Gulf War in a most astonishing fashion. It was, I must say, personally, I saw it pretty dramatically. First of all, I happened to be in England when the war started. And I was on BBC every day from 7 o'clock in the morning till midnight, partly because they couldn't get anybody in England to give any critical comment. The next couple of months, that happened all over Europe. I mean, I spent probably 100 hours on European, Australian radio and television, primarily because they couldn't get any local people to give, you know, the European intellectuals just sold out. Not 100%, there's like five people who were talking. But as a class, they just essentially accepted the U.S. position. They got very jingoistic and so on. And by now, you read, say, the British press or the French press or something, they're just repeating U.S. propaganda on the Middle East. So it's the peace process and, you know, James Baker's gets Nobel Prize and so on and so forth. Well, that, I think, is a reflection of their backing off. Sorry? Sorry.
Would you expect to change in the next, say, 10 years as the EC grows
yeah.
in power?
Yeah, it could. It could. I mean, you know, yeah.
Do you need to follow the European more with the breaking up of NATO or the changing up of NATO?
Yeah, I know. I think a lot of changes could happen in the next 10 years. And of that kind, I think, you know, it's kind of unpredictable. But if the EC moves toward, you know, I mean, it has the capacity to become the world's leading economic power by a substantial margin. And if it, you know, they play the cards right, that's what will happen.
And could that in turn affect
the
state of the Middle East in a reversal way of how it would be the current president?
Well, it depends on whether the U.S. is, I mean, right now, they are in a position of their, I mean, let's not exaggerate. The U.S. is still the major economic power in the world, despite the last 10 years, still the biggest market and the richest economy and everything else. But it's declining. And its long-term prospects are not particularly bright because of the huge indebtedness and the destruction of infrastructure and everything else. If tendencies continue like this, you know, then over time, what you're saying will be correct. The EC will have greater economic clout, and probably so will Japan, though lesser. If they really move into Russia the way they might, they'll even have resource access and market access of the kind they haven't had in the past from a big third world area. That could shift things. But if things continue as they are, the U.S. dominance of the Middle East will largely rely on force. And that's a tricky thing. Force is not easy to use. For one thing, the domestic base for use of force in the United States has eroded, collapsed virtually. There's very little popular acceptance now. There's been a big change, although despite all the, you know, all the breastfeeding and so on, the administration knows perfectly well that they don't have a domestic base for violence. And it's continuing. It's been growing for the last 20, 30 years, called the Vietnam Syndrome, or one thing or another, and it keeps expanding. In the 1980s, the U.S. was unable in Central America to do what it traditionally did when there was problems there. They couldn't send the Marines, you know, couldn't send the B-52s. They had to do clandestine terror because there was just too much domestic opposition. Even the Gulf illustrated that. In fact, the day that the combat started, there was a very important leak, which nobody paid enough attention to. There was a leak of a high-level administration planning document from early 1989, the early days of the Bush administration, on confrontations with the third world. And what it said is very important. It said, In the case of a confrontation with a much weaker enemy, meaning any third world country like Iraq, in the case of a confrontation with a much weaker enemy, we must not only defeat them, but we must defeat them rapidly and decisively, because anything else will undercut political support, which is understood to be very thin. So the options for the use of force are either clandestine terror, which is sort of kept from people, or else huge propaganda campaigns to build up somebody to, you know, pillow the Hun, and then rapidly and decisively defeat them after the whole American population is terrified, and get it over fast because there's no political support for continuing. Well, that narrows the options for intervention. That's the success of the popular movements the last years, and it makes it harder to use this weapon. I suspect that that'll increase. So, you know, reliance on force to dominate the region is not reliable. And yes, I think you're right. Over, say, 10 years, these factors may modify for these reasons.
There is one use of government force that seems to be gaining increasing acceptance in the United States, definitely. And that's one issue that seems, it's one policy whose sole function truly seems to be purely propagandistic.
I don't agree. I think it's more than that. See, it's not just the death penalty. The Reagan-Bush administrations are very strongly opposed to civil rights. They're not conservative. That's just a fraud. Any old-fashioned conservative, like, say, Robert Taft, would turn over in his grave to see what's called conservative today. These guys are radical statists. They want a powerful, violent state, interferes massively in economic affairs, protects itself from interference by the public, demolishes the civil rights system. It's not just the death penalty. Like, one concomitant of the drug war, and probably one of its main purposes, was to create a whole network of possibilities to undermine and destroy the civil liberties protection for the poorer sectors of the population, who, of course, are also targeted by the death penalty. And remember, the United States is moving towards a third world society, too, in certain respects. You know, it's been dramatic over the past 10 years. There's a move towards a two-tiered society, you know. It's a rich country, so it's not going to look like Brazil, but a substantial sector of very wealthy and a huge population that's superfluous. You know, corporations don't need them for labor. They can get it cheaper in northern Mexico. There's nothing to do with these people. You've got to control them somehow. It happens that there's close correlation in the United States between class and race, so that helps too. You know, it's kind of racially identified more or less. But it's really a class thing, basically. Like the poor white working class is basically the same. These people have to be controlled somehow. Well, you can coop them up in their cities. You know, you can stick them in prison. You have to have the rights of the police to go in and do things to them and so on. I think these are all of a piece, and they sort of fall out of the socioeconomic programs the last 10 years.
One second, I just have to make a very quick announcement. Whoever has an Eagle license plate CXN9916, remove their car. Sorry.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's support, but I think that's a little bit like the very thin support that developed for attacking Iraq. I mean, this is a very frightened country. There's no doubt about it. The United States is remarkable, and in fact, to some extent, has become an object of ridicule in Europe because everybody's so terrified. So, for example, like during the Gulf War, Americans were afraid to travel to Europe. That was a big joke all over Europe. You know, what's going to happen if they travel to Europe? In 1986, when, you know, the Reaganites pulled this propaganda trick with Libya as a punching bag, the whole tourist industry in Europe was destroyed because Americans were afraid to travel. You know, there's going to be Arab terrorists hiding, trying to kill you or something. And again, it was an object of ridicule in Europe. But that's part of the system, too. You want to, if the U.S. is going to use force to control things, going to have a frightened population at home. You know, people are scared enough so they're willing to tolerate the use of force. And there's a constant barrage, you know, of directed against the domestic population to frighten them. In fact, that's another part of what the drug war is about. One thing the drug war had nothing to do with is drugs, that's for certain. I don't think there's any discussion about that. But it had other purposes. One purpose was to mobilize the American population in fear. You know, don't forget, you can't appeal to the evil empire anymore. I mean, it's not there, you know. The best PR system can't make you afraid of Stalin. You know, so you need something different, and you got to keep the population frightened. That's the only way you can control them, especially when you're moving towards policies of the kind you mentioned. You know, repressive policies at home. They got to be frightened. They're not going to accept these things. And you're right, people are frightened. Yeah. Well, election, I don't know, but you know, I don't know what the election has much to do with it. But it seems to me it suggests a strategy, namely the usual one, you know, try to get people to open their eyes and to organize and so on.
I have a two-part question. First, regarding the Israelis right now, the two parties they're trying to pull out from the government. Do you think this is a tactic by the Israeli government to delay the peace process, in your opinion, or what?
Well,
the second one is the $10 billion question.
Yeah. just yesterday or today, Tria and Moleta, these two right-wing parties pulled out, which sort of eliminates the government majority. I don't know if it was a tactic, but I suspect the government is not all that unhappy about it, because one of its effects will be to scotch the discussions, which they don't like. Yeah, it means you sort of, means you delay it, yeah. And that's what they want, plainly. They don't want to be, you know, it's a nuisance. I don't expect much to happen, but the whole thing is a nuisance and a bad propaganda show and so on. And now you can have some talk about, you know, here's the greatest democracy in history, so we got to adhere to the democratic process and so on and so forth. You can write the editorials yourself. So that's, we're not faced with that. But I wouldn't, you know, I doubt that it was like a planned tactic. I mean, I think it reflects internal Israeli politics. There's a big problem in Israel, remember, about who's going to pick up the mantle after Shamir goes. Getting pretty old, so who's going to take it over? And there's a lot of jockeying for power about that. A lot of the stuff about the settlements is really internal politics. You know, like Ariel Sharon wants to take over, and he knows his base of support is right-wing settlers, so you know, pushes that. The $10 billion question. Well, that's going to be interesting, actually. The $10 billion is basically for the occupied territory, whatever they pretend. You know, I think people basically understand that. Israel has the funds to absorb refugees, just using them for the territory. They're using about $2 billion a year for settlement of the territories. That's about what they'd get if they got the loan guarantees. So that's not the issue. There's also a number of quite serious questions about the Soviet refugees. Like, why are they being forced to Israel? That's not a humanitarian thing. They don't want, most of them don't want to go to Israel. In fact, just a couple of weeks ago, there was very little reporting here, but there was a really horrifying episode in Holland where several hundred, I forget how many, fair number of Russian Jewish refugees, actually, a lot of them weren't Jewish, but that's pretended Russian Jewish refugees, fled from Israel to Holland, which is, you know, standard asylum. Israel, as always, put a lot of pressure on Holland not to accept them. Israel does not want refugees to be accepted. Holland acceded, they're very pro-Israel, and they forcefully sent them back to Israel. A very ugly scene. The Israeli press covered this extensively, you know, watch people being dragged off the plane by Dutch and Israeli police and tears, and they don't want to be in this horrible place and so on. The American press kept it pretty quiet, but there's a lot of coverage in the Israeli press. Just before that, the head of the Knesset Committee of Absorption and Immigration, Michael Kleiner, wrote an article in Israel in which he complained about the fact that Germany was willing to accept a small number of Russian Jews, and he said what he was going to do. I mean, here's what he said. He said he's going to go to Germany, and he's going to tell the Germans that, I'm quoting, it's Hebrew, but I'm translating, he's going to tell the Germans that they have already fulfilled their quota for discrimination with regard to Jews in this century. And they got to stop. They got to treat the Jews like everyone else. They don't let anyone else in. Don't let the Russian Jews in. So use the Holocaust as a weapon to prevent them from taking in Russian Jews. There was very little criticism of this, I should say, because it's kind of accepted. They've used the same weapon in the United States. You know, so it's considered anti-Semitic for Western countries to accept Russian immigrants. Not that they would accept that many anyway. They don't want them. But there are pressures to drive them to Israel. As far as the humanitarian aspects of it are concerned, whatever the status of Russian Jews is in Russia, and it's not nice, it's not one of the big humanitarian problems in the world. I mean, just to take the obvious one, compare it with the state of roughly equivalent number of Palestinian refugees in Jordan. They didn't leave Kuwait because, you know, the economy is collapsing. They left Kuwait because they were driven out and tortured and so on and so forth, and they're moving to a poor country that doesn't get $10 billion in loans. So just to pick one example, right next door there's a much worse humanitarian problem, and you can think of plenty of others. So it's not a humanitarian issue. I mean, whatever it is, it's not a humanitarian issue. And what's more, the Israeli press is quite frank about this. They say, look, let's stop the press. Yes, okay, because, you know, you just can't, I mean, you can sell it if you like, but it's a fraud. As soon as you look at it, it's obvious, whatever it is, not a humanitarian issue. Now, up until recently, until the American economy started seriously declining, my assumption was that the loan would sail through. But now it's not so certain, because there's a myth that the United States is very munificent and gives a lot of aid to the world. That's a complete myth. The United States is one of the lowest aid donors, and most of the so-called aid is export promotion or something like that. But there is that myth, you know, we're the big benefactor and we give away everything and so on and so forth. And one consequence of the relative, the kind of economic decline is a growing sentiment in the country, the kind of thing, you know, expressed by people like Patrick Buchanan, that we got to stop giving away everything to the whole world. You know? Well, okay, that means there's a big popular base now for opposing a loan that would have sailed through if the Bush administration wants to oppose it. Now, it'll be interesting to see what they do. They can easily block it if they like. My guess is they're going to push it through because I think they want it to go through in some fashion. You know, there may be some finagling. And I suspect, my guess, of course, that they'll, you know, other things being equal, they'll probably push it through because they want to increase the settlements in the occupied territories. I mean, the U.S. can pretend all it likes that it's opposed to the settlements in the occupied territories, but as long as the U.S. keeps funding them, that's not true. The U.S. has always been funding the settlements in the occupied territories. The pretense is we're just standing by helplessly while this, you know, powerful state does what it feels like. I mean, that's not even a joke. The U.S. wants to stop the settlements, it can stop them in 3 minutes.
Would we just take maybe two more questions in light of the time?
What chance do you see in that there could be enough resistance in the West Bank, and also is that peace movement in the Israel that would be in solidarity with opposition in the West Bank to make it politically, make Israel want a political solution, and that would be favorable to Palestine? Is that a fairy tale?
I don't think it's a fairy tale, but I think it depends a lot on what happens here. Israel is so dependent on the United States that nobody can get any political credibility in Israel unless they have backing in the U.S. That's why when Israeli doves come here, real Israelis, say Monty Pellet and these people, they plead with Americans to try to develop some kind of peace movement. Because otherwise, there's no hope for any comparable Israeli group to develop. They're just too dependent on the U.S. As far as things developing in the occupied territories, I think it's extremely unlikely. They took a real beating in the last year, as far as I can tell. But if there are changes here, it could support, you know, pro-accommodation elements within Israel. Sure, it could happen. If it doesn't happen here, it's not going to happen there, I don't think.
One more.
So what should we be doing to build our movement? Should we be telling people to write to Bush, or
no.
Putting ads in the paper,
no.
Or... Now, what are the tactics that are going to make to build a movement here?
You got to judge tactics in your own local situation. You know, I don't know. I mean, what the right tactics are depends on what's happening where you are. You know, like, you can't decide what happens in Seattle, and I have no advice as to what happens here. But the techniques for organizing and, you know, just giving out information and so on, they're not a big secret. They've never changed. You know, it basically takes energy, you know. No, we're talking about the change in American media, and the change in American media is positive.
But I think we should agree that American media should not be relied upon in dissemination of this kind of
thing. Yeah, of course. I mean, that's not a... Look, I mean, I don't know if we're kind of missing gears or something. When I say that the press coverage of the Iraq war was better than the coverage of of the Vietnam War. I mean, it wasn't, you know, like the worst form of totalitarianism. Was like a slightly more relaxed form of totalitarianism. Well, that's an improvement. And that improvement comes from the impact of the popular movement. And that tells you something. It tells you if there's more impact, there can be more improvement.
Well, the movement is seen in the change of the treatment between Peter Arnett and Jane Fonda. As some people doubted even the patriotism of Peter Arnett because he stayed in Baghdad.
Yeah, but notice how much of an improvement that is over the Vietnam War when nobody was in the Vietnam in the NLF territory. Nobody. And she went to Hanoi, you know. Yeah, what was that? Going to Hanoi was nothing. You could go to the Swedish embassy in Hanoi. Well, okay, that's what I'm saying. It's better now, you know. So now there's some kind of, you know, right-wing critique. P.R. Arnett is called controversial, you know. But he's not, but there was no P.R. Arnett during the Indochina War. I agree.
For example, not only they don't cover it at all, and the government of homes and all the atrocities which are continuously being committed against the Palestinians, but worse than that, Robert Siegel, his NPR reporting, he was glorifying the Israeli settlers. I mean, making the American population, look at
these. That's right. And this is much better than it was, much better than it was in the 70s. In the 1970s, there was, first of all, now there is some coverage. So, for example, in Siwan and places like that, there was not any coverage, but pretty accurate coverage. In the 70s and the early 80s, there was nothing, and the same atrocities were going on. And then that was the time when the New York Times was running editorials about, you know, the most benign occupation in human history and so on and so forth. No, that's not what they're not doing anymore. See, your point is, I think you're, you know, like I half agree, but you got to put it the right way. We have to be accurate. The coverage is offensive and disreputable, but it's better, much better. For example, I've been writing about this for the last 20 years and detailing mostly from the Israeli press the atrocities that are going on. And, you know, up until the late 80s, there was virtually no reporting. I mean, there was one moment, 1981-82, when things were really bad for a couple of weeks, and a lot of people were getting killed, and then there was some marginal reporting. But most of the time, it was essentially nothing. Now, in the last couple of years, there's been a fair amount of reporting. I mean, you know, not adequate, but a fair amount. And there is now the kind of critique of the settler movement that you never had back in the 70s. Well, that's a change. And you see the same change in the population. I mean, you know, again, like talks on the Middle East, audiences are radically different than they were. And that's been going all the way through. In the early 70s, you try to make the most mild comment, you get killed, you know, literally. You know. Now, in most of the country, outside of, you know, maybe Los Angeles and New York, you find audiences which are very critical of Israel, and big audiences. In fact, I've had experiences in the Midwest where I ended up defending Israel because the level of anti-Semitism was so extreme and the attacks were so unfair that, you know, I thought they went too far. That's a change. Yeah, let's ask if somebody else a chance. Yeah.
Bush mobilized the National Guard to send them to the Middle East was to transform the image of the National Guard in the eyes of the American public to clean up quails in it. I was wondering, on a scale, where would you put that on a scale from zero to paranoid delusion?
I don't know, I hadn't thought about it, frankly. Maybe you're right.
To totally change subjects for a moment, I'm wondering if you have any comments about what I'm getting very nervous about in this country, maybe it's zero to paranoid delusion, about big business seeming to want to get involved more and more with taking over the public education. We know the relationship of corporations with university education, But now I see it kind of an insidious, quiet movement to get workers for big business by going to the lower levels.
Well, I think you're right, but that's part of a much bigger move. It's a move towards cutting back public services for the general population altogether. I mean, it's on a par with letting the cities collapse and letting the highways collapse and cutting back welfare and so on. And that's something that's been going on since the early 70s. It has to do with what I mentioned before, this crisis that Nixon faced. In the early 1970s, there was a big crisis in the capitalist world altogether. And it became worse in the early 80s. The level of profits were declining. There were three major competitive centers. The U.S. was declining relative to the other two. All of the countries, all of the states turned to more or less the same policies because they were all responding to pretty much the same crisis. They did it at different levels, but it was all what's called conservatism. It's nothing conservative about it. It was all basically trying to divert public resources even more than before towards wealthy sectors, banks, investors, and so on, and that means declining services to the general public. And that goes on worldwide. It's called privatization in the third world. And what you're talking about is just a piece of it. The state is supposed to be a welfare state for the wealthy. It always was, but now more than ever, because there are problems of corporate profits and so on. And so, for example, since the 1970s, there's been a steady decline of real wages, either stagnation or decline for about maybe two-thirds of the population. In fact, and wage earners, non-administrative wage earners, I think are about at the level of 1960 by now. The only way in which families are keeping going is by two wage earners in a family, which means other costs and other social costs and so on. And that's just part of it. And that same thing in England, and the same to an extent happening in the continent, it will be happening in Japan. It means the third world gets it in the neck because they're the first ones to suffer. That's what all these IMF structural adjustment programs are about. And this is a worldwide problem. And the privatization of the schools is part of it. The effect of privatization of the schools will mean that the rich will get good education and other people get nothing. Now, I think there are tendencies in the other direction too. Like, for example, for the first time, the U.S., as I'm sure you know, is the only industrial country outside of South Africa that doesn't have national health insurance. There are all kind of reasons for that. But by now, for the first time, there's business pressure for it. And the reason is the costs are getting too high for industry, for their own needs. So, there's a cost accounting operation going on. So, but yes, there's a lot of pressure on much of the population is largely superfluous in a period with internationalization of capital, migration of production to cheaper areas, supranational banks, and so on and so forth. Much of the population just hasn't had any role. So you kind of stick them in jails or inner cities or something and cut down the level of services to the point where they will prey on each other or something. Very true. It's a very good, it's very ideologically biased, but we learn a lot from it, especially the Hebrew press. The English press, the Jerusalem Post, is a different story because, they figure the Jerusalem Post people are going to read. The Hebrew press is regarded as kind of like a secret language. This is a tribe, remember. It's a tribe which keeps its secrets to itself. You don't let outsiders know about it, and you got a secret language which nobody reads unless they're a member of the tribe, so you can be pretty frank. And if you read the Hebrew press, you learn a lot. I mean, by far the best coverage of the occupied territory for Lebanon is in Hebrew press for years and years. It's true that on international affairs the coverage is not great, but you know, that's like most small countries or even big. You take, say, the Toronto Globe and Mail. Canada's not a small country. And the Toronto Globe and Mail is a big newspaper. Actually, I monitored it for a year because I was going to give some lectures for CBC on the media, and I thought I would talk about their newspaper. We couldn't. I mean, the Toronto Globe and Mail is like probably the local brawling newspaper. It's very parochial. Most places are small towns. Washington and New York are big, you know, are world capitals. London is to a certain extent. Israel is mostly a small town. You know, you have very good, it's very open press, that's true. There are a lot of very good, very courageous and honest journalists in the Hebrew press, and occasionally the English press. But the coverage is parochial. It's only not entirely. For example, the one article I have ever found so far on the current situation in South Vietnam, including, in fact, what I was referring to on the Saigon hospitals and the fetuses and so on, was from an Israeli journalist who was in South Vietnam. Very good Israeli journalist, a Hebrew press.
Is there censorship?
Yeah, there's military censorship, but it's racist. It's mostly against Arabs. There's some censorship against Jews, but not very much, because they're inside the tribe. But I can sense it when I visit there. I can sense it. Like, you know, if you want to be in a very protected position in Israel, what you should do is talk Hebrew with an American accent, because then you've got every possible advantage. You talk Hebrew, you're a member of the tribe, you got an American accent. You know, you come from those rich guys who keep us going. I was able to go with friends into refugee camps that were under military occupation, breaking military curfew and get picked up and so on. But as soon as you start talking Hebrew with an American accent, it kind of everybody relaxes. Racism is a very powerful phenomenon. But one effect of it is the Israeli press happens, the Hebrew press in particular, happens to be very good. I assume that NPR report was quite accurate. I'd be very surprised if there was any constraint on reporting of the Madrid conference. In fact, they get very acid reports. You read the Israeli press, the mainstream Israeli press, equivalent of the New York Times, and there are articles there by one of their top journalists. I quoted in my last article, Z, saying that what the U.S. and Israel want in these Madrid talks is autonomy for the Palestinians, which will be the autonomy of the POW camp, where the prisoners are autonomous to cook their own meals and run cultural events. And then he goes on to explain why. He says, for Israel to really annex, he says, no advocate of greater Israel has ever called for annexation of the territories, because that would be absurd. If you annex the territories, you've got the problem of how to handle the situation, the population. The population then is guaranteed the second-level rights of Israeli Arab citizens. It's true that they're second-class citizens, but they're some kind of citizens. Like, you've got to keep a minimal level of welfare and survival going for them. And you have to extend that to the territories, which would be a huge cost. So it's much better for them to be autonomous. Then you don't offer them anything, and you take heavy taxes from them. So it's perfect. Well, you're not going to read that in the New York Times. And that's typical.
I sometimes wonder whether or not I'm a little too optimistic about the periods coming up ahead. I know there's going to be a big burden and horrible things happening within the capitalist domain, but sometimes I think it might be very positive, because in the alternative communities, I see black activist groups confronting feminism, feminist activist groups confronting racism, the ecological groups confronting both of those problems, and very sophisticated, and it seems like maybe we've gotten rid of some of the religious malice or this or that is things. Am I wrong?
No, I agree with you totally. Absolutely agree with you. You know, in fact, as far as the American left is concerned, I think the collapse of the Soviet system was a step forward. They were always passionately anti-socialist back to 1917, and that's just another impediment going. And I also agree with you about the popular movements. It is positive. I mean, I'm one of, I guess, maybe I'm crazy, but I thought that the Iraq war experience was showed the power of the left and the peace movement by comparison to anything before. Now, it wasn't enough to stop it, but it was, by comparison to anything before, it was a big advance.
But there hasn't been any coverage afterwards of the devastation of the entire
area.
That's
not true.
Well, I mean, you know, there hasn't been massive
Look,
coverage.
Frontline, for example, ran an hour by Andrew and Leslie Coburn, which was extremely good. Very good. And, you know, there have been other things. That's a lot different from what we used to get. Okay, that's something. I'd say, maybe NPR is pretty rotten, but NPR did get pretty extensive coverage for this Census Bureau report on the post-war Iraqi casualties. Well, that wouldn't happen before.